Good morning. It's 9 after 6 on Tuesday, April 15th, 2008. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network. My guest this hour is the author of the book, You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. We're going to talk about the ideas raised by its author, and we'll take your comments and questions, too, as usual. Here are your phone numbers, 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number, 800-642-1234. In Madison, please use our local number, 263-1890, 263-1890. You can also send us an email. Here's the address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Rabbi Brad Hirschfield is president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership and a popular commentator on religion and society. He's also the host of Building Bridges on Bridges TV, the American Muslim Television Network, and he joins me by telephone this morning. Good morning, Rabbi Hirschfield, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
When you write about religious fanaticism, you're writing from your own personal experience. Tell us about that, please.
I am. When I was in my late teens and early 20s, I was, by all accounts, a fanatic. And I suppose what I should do from the outset is explain what I mean when I say fanatic, because it doesn't really matter what flag you wave or what colored turban or headdress you happen to wear or which name you use for God or any cause you're committed to. A fanatic for me is anyone who thinks they're 100% right, 100% of the time, who thinks with absolute certainty they know exactly what to do at every moment and are prepared to do it at all costs. And so by that definition, you can be a fanatic about anything. For me, the expression of my fanaticism had to do with becoming very committed not only to leaving my home in the suburbs of Chicago and going to study at an all-male Orthodox seminary, yeshiva, in the state of Israel, but actually becoming involved with the settlement movement, not only with the settlement movement, but ultimately living for periods of time in the city of Hebron, which was probably at that time the most disputed piece of territory anywhere on the face of the planet. I was one of about 100 Jews living amidst 100,000 Palestinians, and I would say the fanaticism lay in the fact that, as I said, I was certain that I was doing what God wanted. And because of that certainty about knowing what God wanted, nothing else really mattered.
So are you, just for clarification, are you saying that it's not possible for someone to be certain about what God wants?
I think that one can be up to 99% certain. In other words, I think we can be certain enough to stake our lives on something, but never so certain is to get rid of all questions. It seems to me that if one is truly a believer, especially in God, that requires a certain degree of humility. And humility is the space from which questions open up. So I guess what I think it would be like is I'd rather people be 51% certain. Because, you know, if you're 51% certain, you still go and do it. But it leaves you 49% open for questions. I mean, make a very simple analogy. If you're standing there waiting for a bus, and the bus comes by, and you're not certain if it's the right one you're supposed to get on or not, but you're 51-52% certain, you get on, and you go for the ride. Now, from the outside, you look 100% sure because you did board the bus. But if you're only 51 or 52% certain, my guess is that you watch the street signs, and you look at the other people traveling with you, and you look at the people you're passing on the side of the road in a whole different way than if you boarded that bus 100% certain that it's the only one for you.
So how did you go from being 100% certain to being 99% certain or less? What changed your way of thinking?
A series of things changed, but what finally was the linchpin for me in many ways was when a group of settlers, people who I actually knew, having been attacked, committed their own act of terrorism, their own act of reprisal, and two civilians were killed in an Islamic college in Hebron. Now, I want to be very, very clear about this. I understand fully that in wars, people get hurt. So So, I think this is not directly what you asked, but important to bring up. Anyone who thinks you can go to war and not have innocent people die doesn't understand war. And so any time we're told we should go to war because the good guys will be killing the bad guys and it's that simple, should know they're being lied to. I'm not suggesting what policy should be about the war America is currently involved in or not, but I am saying that if anyone believes it is possible to go to battle and not live with the moral ambiguity and the hurt that's caused by the fact that innocent people will die, should not be in war at all. Anyone who thinks you can go into battle and it's as clean as the good people killing the bad people does not belong fighting the war. If you can't admit that you will hurt others as well, then you probably shouldn't be fighting. So it's not that I was completely unnerved by the fact that civilians were killed. What unnerved me was that when we started to talk about it, when I went to ask certain leaders in the settlement community, hey, what's going on here? These were supposed to be our best and our brightest. These were men who were officers in the army. These were men who were rabbis. And now we're killing civilians? And the response was, look, it's a tragedy because the people they killed are civilians, are innocent, and it's a shame. But it's not the time to be asking big questions about what we're doing here.
We're at weather time. We'll pick up this story when we come back from finding out what kind of day it's going to be for people around the state of Wisconsin. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 17 minutes after 6 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine this week. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on the Ideas Network. Play is an important part of human and animal life. After 4, Ben Marins and his guests talk about the play behavior of animals and what it reveals about the need for play in our own lives. That's after 4 o'clock today, At Issue with Ben Marins. This hour, we're talking about honoring traditions in religion and various other topics related to that. My guest is Brad Hirschfield, who is president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. He's the host of Building Bridges on Bridges TV, the American Muslim Television Network. He's also the host of a weekly radio show called Hirschfield and Kula. And he's the author of the book, You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right. You can join our conversation this morning. Here's how to do that. The numbers are 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number, 800-642-1234. In Madison, please use our local number 263-1890, 263-1890. You can also send us an email. talk@wpr.org is the address, talk@wpr.org. So, Rabbi Hirschfield, we were talking before the break. You were explaining how your viewpoint changed when you saw this incident in Hebron, and what happened after that? How did you act on your new feelings?
Well, I guess, John, what happened was that, as I said, the fact that an act of excess of Jewish terror had been committed itself probably wouldn't have shaken me to the core. But what I know is when there are excesses being committed in a community and no one wants to talk about it, when the passions we feel drive out the questions we need to be asking, something is deeply broken. And so I ended up leaving Israel. I want to be fair. The truth is, if I were a little bit older and a little bit wiser, I know now that I could have found a way to stay in Israel even if I had left that settlement movement. But at the time, I really didn't know how to do that. That was my community, and I was so disturbed and so distraught that I thought, you know what, better to start again back in America. And ironically, what I found is that it was in the United States, I returned to America and attended the University of Chicago, that it was in America that I was better able to create the kind of spiritual life that I wanted because of the fundamental pluralism and openness and diversity that are woven into the fabric of our society. I mean, we're far from perfect. On the other hand, I re-encountered the country in which I was raised in a whole new way, and I saw the possibilities of the kind of spiritual depth that come with the kind of spiritual range that exists in our culture.
The premise of your book is contained in the title, but what I would like to know is, what do you really mean by saying you don't have to be wrong for me to be right? Because at first glance, that looks like moral relativism.
Well, I'll tell you what. I would rather, in an age of more religious violence than any time since the Crusades, an era when more people are dying in the name of God than any time since the 14th century, a moment when our own State Department and the United Nations tell us that as much as 80% of global violence is somehow rooted in religious conflict, I would rather err on the side of relativism than of absolutism, simply because I think fewer of us will die. That having been said, I'm not a relativist. A relativist seems to me as someone who doesn't know how to act at all because all the options seem equal. I am, however, a passionate pluralist, which means I believe one can act with passion and commitment without building up a sense of their own rightness based on everyone else's wrongness. I mean, the simplest way to imagine it is for anyone who's lucky enough to wake up next to someone every morning, imagine rolling over and looking at them as you both open your eyes, saying, "Honey, the reason we're together is not because you're so beautiful or smart or kind, but everyone else in the world is so damn ugly, stupid, and mean, I think I'll stick with you." And that's not a way to build a healthy relationship, not with the person or the ideas or the country you love, and certainly not with the ones you don't.
Well, that makes me feel good, because I've always considered myself a radical moderate, and I don't feel so squishy about that now.
No, the test, I think radical moderate's a great term. Everyone who thinks that has that one question, though. What are the actions we take in light of that radical moderation? Because the word radical, right, like from the Latin, originally means to go to the root. So if you tap into the root of what allows you to be a passionate or a radical moderate, you then ask, how do I live that approach day to day? How does it shape my thoughts, my feelings, my politics, my interactions with other people? And if you can answer that, if there are really hard actions that come with that squishy-sounding phrase, then that's perfect. That's actually what we need. We need people who live with an awareness that theirs is not the only way, but it's a way that motivates them enough to make a difference in the world.
Well, that's really getting down to the nub of it, because we all struggle with matching our behavior to what we believe to be right, and that's something I think all of us struggle with on a daily basis, regardless of what you believe. I think we all struggle with that regularly.
Yeah, I think we do. And here's the thing: I think if what happens when your struggle to match your behavior with what you think is right bleeds into a sense that anyone who has reached a different conclusion is by definition wrong, you have a problem. That doesn't mean you can't say certain things are wrong. The title is not, you know, I'm okay, you're okay. The title is not, I'm right, and you are right too, and so is the next guy. The title is simply that you don't have to be wrong. You may be wrong, but you don't have to be wrong to make me feel good about being right. That's the issue. It's not there are no rights and wrongs. There are rights and wrongs. Quite honestly, I believe there are things worth fighting for in this world. I am not a pacifist. I believe there are causes that not only are worth fighting for with words, but may ultimately be fighting for with guns. But I know this. When you think that yours is the only way, however good it starts out, it always ends badly.
We have some callers who want to join our discussion. Let's invite George from Mequon. You're first. Go ahead.
Good morning. My question really relates to what common ground that you found you've been able to establish with persons who are not from the Judeo-Christian tradition, and how you've been able to establish common ground, whether it's through relationships, through ideas, through ideology. If you have any ideas on that, I'd love to hear your answers off the air.
Sure, George, it's a great question, and the need to establish common ground is critical. What I'll tell you is, and actually this is the way we'll start with the hardest situations, the people most alien to us, on whatever basis. You come into that conversation, into that encounter, wanting to share your views and your ideas with them, which, of course, is exactly what they're coming to do, share their ideas with you. Here's what I know. Before you can be someone else's teacher of your ideas, you must be a student of theirs. And when you're willing to be a student of someone else's ideas, ultimately, you will be able to also teach your own. Common ground is not established because you know there's going to be an agreement at the end. Common ground is established because you have genuine curiosity about the person you're encountering, and the curiosity that you show about them, in my experience, usually evinces a similar curiosity from them. It's very important that we not confuse common ground with shared conclusions. If we do that, then actually, we're just all evangelizing each other. We're just all trying to make converts. And that's not the way to create common ground. The genuine curiosity about each other really is. See, there's going to be difference. There's always going to be difference. One of the biggest problems in these kind of encounters is people think we're supposed to meet up with those who are not like us in order to become more alike. I don't think that's true. I think we meet up with people who are not like us in order to learn how to manage the differences without sinking to the level of denigration and destruction. And if we do that, then actually the difference becomes an incredible resource as opposed to something to be feared.
Well, there's a Native American aphorism that speaks of walking a mile in another man's moccasins, and that sounds a little bit like what you're saying.
I think, John, it is. Although I think you there, we have to be a little bit careful because I always start with the premise that I can't fully walk in someone else's shoes. And what I'd rather do is say, you know what? Because I know I can't, I need to make some space for your thinking and your approach and your conclusions, because they're really yours, and they come out of your experience. And so what I can try and do is have a kind of empathy and at the same time admit, no, I really can't fully understand someone else's experience. And because I can't, I can cut them a little slack. I can always leave a little room for that piece of them that I don't understand, because we do have different experiences. And so I think you're right. That combination of trying to walk in someone else's shoes and then the admission that I never fully can because they are their shoes, not mine, can leave us open to the two things that have to happen, the real need for encounter and shared experience and the recognition that there are real differences that sometimes we can't fully understand. But as long as they don't become excuses for hurting each other, we can probably live with.
We're just about at news time, and we'll come back to our discussion with Rabbi Hirschfield after we hear some news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. By the way, Rabbi Hirschfield will be coming to Madison to give a speech, Finding Faith Without Fanaticism. That's May 7th at 7:30 p.m. in the Chapel of Press House at 731 State Street Mall on the UW-Madison campus. Again, that's coming up May 7th at 7:30 in Madison. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 6:35, good morning. John Munson here in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, my guest is Rabbi Brad Hirschfield, who is president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. He's the host of a weekly radio show called Hirschfield and Kula. He's also the host of a television program, Building Bridges, on Bridges TV, the American Muslim Television Network. And he's the author of You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right. Here's how you can join our discussion this morning. Call a toll-free number, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can send, if you're in Madison, you can use our local number, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or you can send us an email. Here's the address, talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We have some callers who want to join the discussion this morning. Let's go next to Carrie in Augusta. Carrie, good morning.
Good morning. I have a kind of a double question, but it's the same for Rabbi Hirschfeld. I'm wondering if he had a chance to watch the compassion dialogue between the two Democratic presidential candidates and what his thoughts were on that. And then the second part is what his feelings are on faith entering into public policy decision-making. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
They're both great questions, John. Carrie, let me answer your first question second and be a little bit more provocative. The second question about the relationship between our personal faith and public life. I actually think it's very important that our faith have a role in public life and in politics. I think one of the challenges, and in fact one of the reasons I wrote You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right, is because I don't think right now most of us who have a deep faith are so good at bringing it into the public square, because too often we've been told that to have a deep faith commitment is to expect everyone else to share it. And if that's the case, then no, it doesn't belong in the public square. But if we understand our deep faith commitments as the underpinnings of our greatest hopes and our most serious aspirations, our dreams for our future and the future of the world in which we live, then how could the system which fuels those hopes and dreams, which is the language of those aspirations, which is what our faith should be, how could it not shape our understanding of politics and public life? But I think that with all those hopes and aspirations and dreams, we need to bring a faith that admits ours is not the only one. And then when we do that, there really can be room for God in the voting booth. The issue, though, has to do with whether or not you think there's room for someone else's understanding of God in that voting booth also. If you don't, then leave it all out. But that would leave us with what Catholic intellectual Richard John Neuhouse once called a naked public square. And I'm not interested in a naked public square. What I'm interested in is us developing a public ethic of religious integration, which leaves room for different religious views. I did see the conference or the conversation on compassion. I think, frankly, I was more excited by the fact that it occurred than the way either of the candidates behaved. I don't think we've gotten to the place yet where people are able to talk about the genuine questions that they have as a part of their faith. I don't think we've gotten to a place yet where we have politicians who are willing to talk about the fact that their doubts, that their concerns and their questions about how faith is functioning are able to be as much a part of the discussion of faith as all the kind of sweetness and light stuff. And I appreciate the sweetness and light, but if that was really the only face of faith, then the world would be a much safer place. So it's precisely because I love faith that I think it's really important we be willing to ask tough questions of the faithful. In fact, that's the deepest expression of love, when you're willing to say, look, there are some real problems here, but don't worry, because I'll hang in forever and try and solve them.
When we look at the major religions in the world, at their core, for those who are believers, there should be a manifestation of behavior. In other words, there should be behaviors that match the values of the whatever the religion happens to be. And I'll speak from the Christian tradition. Jesus said that all of the law and the prophets was summarized in love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul and all your might, and love your neighbor as yourself. And that should produce a set of behaviors. If that is being practiced, that should produce a set of behaviors that will affect people near that person without having to preach or even necessarily say anything.
Well, John, I agree with you, although there's a little bit of a rub here, because the most horrific actions in the world have been propagated by people who are quoting beautiful texts. Right? The Crusaders who traveled across Europe murdering Jews as a prelude to arriving in the Holy Land in order to commit mass murder against Muslims actually believed that that was an expression of love. Their experience was that divine love took many forms, and they actually talked about the violence that they were doing as an expression of that divine love. So I think the most important thing to do, rather than figure out how each of our faiths teaches something beautiful, because they all do, but the people who do terrible things think they're doing something beautiful. It would be more helpful to imagine, what do each of our faiths have to teach about those who lie beyond the range of our faith? And ask ourselves if we're treating those people in the way they really should be treated, in a way they want to be treated, in a way that we think history will be proud of. Right? I'm all for bridging gaps. I think there are really only two questions. The first is, how do you reach people beyond your community and connect with them? But then I think we should admit there are those we'll never connect with and ask, how are they impacted by the beliefs that we have and the things in which we believe? And while that's not always as great, you know, there's a teaching in the Talmud in which there's a debate about what is the single greatest teaching among for rabbinic Jews. And one rabbi says it is, as you said, love your neighbor as yourself. And another rabbi says, no, that's not the greatest. I suspect because he felt that there are times we're not so loving. He said the greatest is to remember the teaching of Genesis, that we all come from one original couple. Whether that's true historically or not, he wanted to remind all people that at the end of the day, we're one family. We may not always love every member of the family, but let's try and remember that no matter what, however love-filled we are or rage-filled we may be, we are one family, and try and keep it a family fight. Because when we're actually hurting one member of the family, we are hurting all of us. And that doesn't mean we'll always stop all the fights before they happen. It just means we'll understand that when I'm fighting against you, I'm also fighting against myself.
Let's take a call next from Jim in Footville. Jim, good morning.
Yes, after many years of research, I find that Judaism is 4,300 years old. Now, Rabbi, you seem glib and possibly a savant, erudite and pedagogical. My question is, who is God? Where is he? Can I talk to him today? What about sending a letter or a missive or possibly an email or a fax or text messaging? I'd like to hear from him as would billions of other people. Let's stop the delusion around here. The Christians don't even want to broach the topic. I ask them every week, where is he, who is he, and I can't find a definitive answer. Let's cut the propaganda and the innuendo and get to the crux of things here. Where is God and who is he?
I think we'll have to hold the answer to that question till after the weather break, because I have a hunch it's going to take longer than we have. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll hear Rabbi Hirschfeld's response to the last caller. I'm John Munson. You're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 6:46. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next hour, as violence over food shortages erupts around the globe, immediate international action is urged by the World Bank. And my guest after 7 disagrees, saying there's plenty of food, just not enough money to pay for it. That's after 7 o'clock this morning. This hour, we're talking about religion and religious differences with Rabbi Brad Hirschfeld, president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. He's the host of a radio program called Hirschfeld and Kula, and he is also the host of a television program, Building Bridges, on Bridges TV, the American Muslim Television Network. And he's the author of You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right. Well, Rabbi Hirschfeld, that was quite a big question that we got just before the weather. Now is your chance to respond.
Well, then let me try and respond to Jim's question in two ways. First of all, there's a piece of me that wonders if his question, where is God and where is he, I kind of felt perhaps wasn't the genuine question, that it was kind of trying to reduce to absurdity anyone who chooses to believe. And there are two quick responses to that. First of all, the idea that we can reduce other people's faith choices to absurdities is an expression of simply the fanaticism of no faith. which is every bit as dangerous as fanatical faith, because it is as certain as the faithful that it has reached all the necessary conclusions. So I think that's the first thing to know, that fanatical secularism is just as dangerous as fanatical faith. The other possibility is that, you know, it is a genuine question, and he's really looking for God. So let me try and answer. And the first part of the answer is, God is wherever you, Jim, let God be. That one of the things, actually, which is common to all faiths that I know, is that each faith calls its faithful to witness God's presence in the world. So quite literally, God is wherever we let God be. I actually think that's why atheism is a quite religious response to the awareness that the God we learned about in when we were 5 and 6 years old doesn't really exist. That if there is some great puppet master making everything perfect, we wouldn't have shows about food riots in a world where there is plenty of food and where there's actually even enough money. We wouldn't have people dying of curable diseases. We wouldn't have car bombings. We wouldn't have those things. So in many ways, I look at an atheist and say, wow, your disbelief has more holiness than my belief on a lot of days. Because you've read the newspaper and said, that God doesn't exist. Because if that God existed, this world wouldn't look that way. And those are the people who get up off their chairs and they go and do something to make the world better. And in religious language, that is witnessing. So God is wherever we let God be, including the God we don't believe in. And then there's an important issue to remember when we ask that question about where is God, because you notice Jim kept saying, where is he? What if God's not a he? You know, I remember once putting my daughter, who's now 14, to bed. She was about 4 or 5 years old. And as I was kissing her goodnight, she said, Abba, it's Hebrew for dad, it's what she calls me, I know who God is. Well, that got my attention. And I said, really, honey, who is God? She said, God is a 12-year-old girl who loves me very much. And I said, you're right. And I gave her a kiss and left the room. Because at the end of the day, whatever God we call on or the no God we believe in is always the biggest possible projection of that which we think is best and most loving in the world. And so for my 4-year-old, that was a big 12-year-old girl, a big version of herself who loved her unconditionally. So I think God is wherever we let God be, and we should always have the modesty to admit that we call on the God we most need and can most understand, which is another way of saying that there are as many ways to understand God as there are people who choose to, which strikes me as about right if the God in which we believe is infinite. How could there not be infinite understandings and expressions?
800-642-1234, that's a toll-free number. We have lines available for you right now, 800-642-1234. In Madison, that's 263-1890, 263-1890. The email is talk@wpr.org, and we have an email from Sophie in Waukesha, who is Muslim, and wants to know what the rabbi thinks is the best solution in the Middle East.
Let's see, do we have about 10 or 12 years to talk about that?
No.
Right. Look, I think the first thing to understand is that whatever solutions are coming in the Middle East, these are generational problems, and there will not be any short-term solutions. That's the first thing, that we're going to have to widen the time frame. The second thing is that any person advocating a solution in which their community, however they understand that, is not going to be made a little bit uncomfortable and have to do some self-correcting is not really looking for a solution at all. They're looking to impose an outcome on the other side. I think that ultimately what had been, now we're talking politics and pragmatics, had been a shared conclusion until recently, that the issues of Israel and Palestine are only going to be addressed by the creation of two independent nations for two people that over time, hopefully, will emerge as partners and not as antagonists. but that in the end, their individual security, authenticity, and identity has to be secured, was what everyone hoped for. That is still the hope, I believe, of most Americans. That is still the hope, I know, based on polling of most Israelis. Khalil Shikaki, who's probably the Palestinians' leading pollster, public policy analyst, has recently produced polls that are quite troubling because it seems that is no longer the conclusion shared by most Palestinians. And so I think there are going to be real questions in the months ahead. What does it mean to try and create a solution which for some people involves the recognition of two states for two peoples living in safety and security if one side of that negotiation really isn't so interested? That doesn't mean you have to stop. You can stop talking, because you can't. And it doesn't mean that in the end most Israelis still don't support that, because they know that long-term occupation is not the way to go. Though I do think it's going to make the process more complicated, it certainly can't be used as an excuse to disengage from that process.
Let's take a call next from Joseph in Milwaukee. Joseph, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good.
Great.
Wonderful. First of all, Rabbi Hirschfield, I'm amazed. I'm on my way to work, and your oratory is absolutely phenomenal. That being said, I have a question. If you're aware of there's different sects and different types of Muslims. There's a certain type of Muslims. They're called Ahmadis. Internationally, they're recognized as blasphemous Muslims because the other Muslim sects have created a personal biased incentive to label them blasphemous. But that being said, the Western nations do help us out because Ahmadi Muslims are recognized as peaceful Muslims, but they're still being persecuted rampantly. I would just like to see what your take would be on that, how we could resolve that issue to come to an understanding of our similarities and not forcefully be barbaric amongst our differences, and I'll take that off the air. Thank you.
Joseph, you've raised a really important issue. Important not because I'm going to comment on Ahmadi and legitimacy and not legitimacy within a community, not my own, but because I think that all communities, political, religious, and otherwise, tend to focus on how others outside the community are doing stuff to them, as opposed to saying, wow, I wonder if we're treating our own membership well and properly. And probably until that can be addressed, you can't make peace with others outside your camp until you make peace within your camp. So, and this may have to do with the previous call also, it would be fascinating if for 1 year every political and ethnic religious community on the planet said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to hold all of our fights with others in abeyance for 1 year, a one-year moratorium on any dealing with them and simply dealing with ourselves and seeing if we can treat all the people who claim to be a part of our community a little bit better. My guess is that that will both heal a lot of issues within the community and also prepare each community to deal with those beyond it. And so that's what I would hope for. The issue here is not for me to make a pronouncement about the authenticity or legitimacy of an individual Islamic school of thought. What I can say is that there is no community that doesn't have its own members or dissident members who feel they are mistreated, and that in the long term, addressing those issues actually is a path to dealing with issues between people of different communities. Deal with what's close to home first. It's amazing how it prepares you to deal with what's further afield.
Rabbi Hirschfield, I know you're coming to Madison in May 7th. You'll be speaking at an annual conference on perspectives on the Abrahamic traditions, leadership commonalities, and critical reflections. We've got about 40 seconds left in the program here. Can you give us a preview of what you're going to be talking about in Finding Faith Without Fanaticism?
Yeah, just that. I'm going to talk about how it is possible to lay claim to a faith which we deeply hold and want to celebrate publicly, and at the same time do it in a way that is not fanatical, that makes room for people of other faith, that understands that our questions are as sacred as our answers, and understands that this really is the pursuit of the infinite. So there will be many, many expressions and many, many forms of following that infinite. We each have to pick our own, but having picked our own doesn't necessitate hating or disrespecting or disregarding that which we have to learn from all of the others. And that's true whether it's a faith issue or a personal family issue. In the end, it's just about using these traditions to make our lives and then ultimately this world a little bit better.
Well, I want to thank you for our conversation this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Rabbi Brad Hirschfield, president of the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership and author of the book You Don't Have to Be Wrong for Me to Be Right. He'll be speaking in Madison on May 7th at 7:30 at the Chapel of Press House at 731 State Street Mall on the UW-Madison campus. This program was produced by Carmen Jackson with on-air production by Karen Prager. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine this morning here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.